You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. Hi, everyone. I'm back. I'm here. I'm still here. Thank you for joining me and for your support during my hiatus. I'm looking forward to sharing the next 8 episodes with you bi-weekly in this new season format. And I'm sending love to all of you. How are you doing? During this break time, my husband was doing a play in San Diego, and I was working my day job full-time from home while solo parenting. Luckily, with the help of my mom generously staying with us for a while and a hodgepodge of babysitters, in-laws visiting over the Thanksgiving, it was a patchwork. And now Frankie is back, and we're rolling together as a family again, thank goodness. I hope you're taking care of yourselves. This Omicron wave is so overwhelming and infuriating after all of this time. But I want to introduce you to my guest today. It's Jeffrey Allen Murphy. He's a fantastic and talented actor who I've been lucky to know from way back. We did the Chautauqua Summer Theater program together the summer before my senior year of undergrad, and then wound up together for 4 solid years at Juilliard for grad school. He's been understudying To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, and we recorded this at the end of October during the hiatus. So it was before the current COVID spike. I know he was going on a lot during Omicron, and it was just announced in mid-January that the show is on hold now until the beginning of June. I'm so grateful for his time and his openness with me, and I hope you enjoy the 179th episode of The Compass. What do you do to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
And great question.
Wrapped up in that is, when I say the dark side, what comes to your mind? What is that most often for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it presents itself in a few different ways. I think frequently one that comes up is jealousy. I think that that's something that everybody in our business, you know, struggles with. Because there's a finite amount of things to be doing and everybody wants to do all the things. And I think that that's a normal emotion for people who work in the arts. So that's one aspect of the dark side. Another aspect is, you know, the idea of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Definitely is a huge one.
Does that hit you most often when you're between work or when you're actually working on a project? Just curious.
Ooh, I think it actually hits me most when I'm in the project. Hmm. Like, especially like at the beginning of a project, when you're like, you don't feel like you have your feet fully under you.
Right.
And you're like making a choice and you're like, I don't know about this choice. And you know, it's that can definitely maybe like, or if you're like working with a bunch of people who you're like, these people are all really good. Am I the person who sucks in this show? So, I mean, it pops up in different times. And for me, also, the dark side presents itself as just like profound social anxiety.
Right.
And those are all, I think, one of the beautiful things about getting older is getting to know when you're having your dark side attacks. Because when I was younger, I would just be in the middle of the storm and I wouldn't even know what was going on. And now I'm like, okay, I'm having these feelings and they're not grounded in reality.
And this has happened before and I've survived.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's kind of off topic, but I have one tattoo. And it's just the word temporary. And there's two reasons for it. One, I think it's funny to, you know, oh, you have a tattoo? Yeah, I have a temporary tattoo. But no, it's a kind of a reminder for me that everything is temporary. You know, if I'm going through a really hard time, that's temporary. If I'm going through a great time, that's also temporary. So that is the only thing I've... Yeah, I love it too. So I think that we all have to find what works for us in order to fight the dark side. One thing, I know this is going to sound maybe a little weird. I love watching documentaries about like space. Or like if I was living out in the country, I'd just sit and I'd look at like the stars or something like that.
It's because like zoom out as far as possible.
As far as possible. Because it just, none of the things that are bugging me really matter. You know, humanity is a blip on the history of, you know, the universe. And certainly whether or not I get this job or whether so-and-so, you know, likes me or whatever, that doesn't really matter, you know?
Right.
It is funny, I think, how we get so, and I'm speaking about myself here, we get so wrapped up in how important these little things are. And while I think art is important, you know, we aren't actually, you know, curing diseases or things like that. You know, if I do a terrible job acting, no one dies, which ideally. I mean, I haven't acted that poorly yet, but, you know, give me time. But yeah, it's
balancing that. We're like, yes, of course, you're right. It's not that dire. And then also the, I guess since we are people who are marrying art with commerce, like the stakes of I'm trying to provide for my life and pay for things like food and housing, which are dire, you know, things like that. So it is an interesting conundrum.
Well, I certainly hear you on that. I don't know. I mean, I feel like a lot of the dark side aspects for me and for some of my friends, they all wrap around. I mean, working in acting, it is such a bizarre dance you do with your own ego. Because you have to think you're really good to stick with it. You know, you have to feel like you have something to say, or you have to feel like you can be a useful, you know, you have to think you're an artist in order to do the thing, but you have to be able to put it aside in order to go some of these places emotionally. You have to be able to put it aside to deal with this life that we live. So I guess that's why pulling way back, you know, and looking at the stars, and sometimes I'll like watch documentaries about like horrible things that have happened in the past, and that will also remind me that I'm like, this isn't so bad.
Right.
It's like, you know, this isn't the, you know, plague of 16, whatever, you know.
Well, on that subject though, can we talk a little bit about how you've been over the course of the pandemic and how you're doing now? What has this bizarre time been like for you?
It's a year and a half that's felt like a decade. I don't think anybody was like having a great time during the, I mean, maybe somebody was, but it was such a weird, weird transition. Because 2 weeks before we shut down, I'm in the show To Kill a Mockingbird, and we did a show in Madison Square Garden for 18,000 school children on February 26th of 2020.
Oh my goodness.
Which was incredibly stressful for everybody involved, but the actual day of it was amazing. I doubt I'll ever be privy to an audience that is that exciting and electric, and you know, it was really a fantastic experience. And it was probably a super spreader event if we're being real.
Very possibly.
I mean, hindsight's, you know, 2020.
Right, of course.
Pun not intended. But But yeah, and then 2 weeks later, it's just like, okay, don't come to work today. You know? And then it's like, things just kept getting kicked down the road. And the first few weeks, I think, you know, a lot of us were like, oh, cool. This is a nice little vacation. You know, we were still getting paid for the first couple of weeks. Interestingly, once we got into the meat of the pandemic, I found it, certain aspects of it, very relieving. Because I no longer felt like I was, I had no FOMO, you know?
Yeah, it was unique in that way.
Where it's like, oh, there's nothing I should be doing. There's nothing right. that
Everything
I...
shut down.
Yeah. Yeah, and being like, oh... and then the whole thing of like jealousy, like there was no one to be jealous of. We were all in the exact same position.
Right.
And so that was, you know, relieving for like, I don't know, a couple of days. but it was a challenge. And I worked hard to just fill my time and try and get a schedule going. You know, I had a group of friends. We'd get together on Zoom every week to read a play, which was really, really, it was really valuable just to have an opportunity to do the thing, even if it's just your friends, you know? And I also played like online trivia with friends a lot. I mean, it was such a bizarre time. And I also felt very lucky knowing that there was a job that I would go back to.
Right, because your show had been doing well enough that that seemed predetermined.
Yeah, obviously all because of my work. no, I mean, it's a great show, but like I was very lucky. I am very lucky to be a part of it now. I was lucky to be part of it then. But it's very unusual to have a job that sticks around this long period.
Yeah, of course.
So, but that was... And another thing that I was going through, I don't know if this will be of any interest to anybody else, but like I had a back injury that I was trying to get back surgery for. And I was just
This all started, or did it happen during the pandemic?
I got injured myself in 2019, and it was excruciatingly painful, and I was working through it. And by my own choice, nobody was, you know, forcing me to do anything.
Right.
But I was working through it, and then the pandemic came along, and it's like, okay, I need to get spinal surgery. This is the time to do it. And the bureaucratic nightmare that was involved with that was awful.
To get workers' comp, or
yeah, and it took over a year to get it approved.
Wow,
which was
a year of you experiencing the pain.
Well, and it was also a year of, you know, oh, file this paperwork, wait X number of weeks to hear back. Oh no, they say no. Okay, then we have to appeal it, and then it was just. And then during that time, also, you know, we had that like, oh, it'll be 4 weeks. Oh, it'll be 6 weeks. Oh, it'll be 6 months. It'll be
the shutdown.
You know, for yeah, the shutdown. Yeah, so it was a real experiment for all of us in patience. But it also, I think, reminded a lot of us of what matters, you know, because, I mean, you can create art anywhere. You can express yourself anywhere. A job, yes, it's great. You know, it's important to make money. And obviously we all need to eat, you know, and have a place to sleep and need to be able to buy, you know, toys for our cats and so forth. But it's... I don't know. I mean, it's important that our loved ones are a part of our lives and that we are there for them and that we're, you know, it's that, you know, I feel like that was an important reminder that like work isn't everything.
Yeah. Especially with the demands that our industry puts on you. And I know a lot of those are being discussed now with things like the 5-day rehearsal week or the number of shows, the, you know, discussion over the 10 out of 12 hour workdays during tech. which I'm excited about. And but I mean, it was interesting, like when it's always like the show must go on, the show must go on, to actually have a time when the show couldn't go on and for people to be like, oh, right, I'm a human.
Yeah. And I'm sure it was, valuable. You know, even more special for parents, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I am not I'm a cat parent, but that's different.
I know your family is not too far away. Did you get to spend any time with them?
No, I didn't get to spend any time with them other than on Zoom. You know, it's, you know, with the frustration is that at least with the situation of my apartment, there was no ability to really properly isolate. You know, in order to do our laundry, we had to go around the corner to a laundromat. In order to, you know, get groceries and not,
right,
you know, pay a crazy amount of money, we had to go to the grocery store. And so there was no way that we could really properly isolate in a way that would be safe for a person with immunocompromised, with pre-existing conditions to be around, which was really hard. It was really hard. Because my parents, they don't live that far away. They live like an hour and a half away. And I didn't get to see them for, you know, like a year plus, yeah. You know? So it's, so that was a challenging bit for sure. But yeah, I was just here in my apartment in New York, sitting on my fire escape, which, with my girlfriend. So that's, you know,
that's good.
Yeah, you know, somehow she has managed to tolerate me throughout being locked in.
It's a big test.
For everybody. Yeah.
So tell us about what the last, like, month has been like, because you guys are open now. You're performing.
We are. It has been.
And are you, I'm sorry, are you an offstage cover, or are you on the show every night? Okay, offstage.
Yeah. Which is honestly, being an offstage cover is a challenge to the ego of its. I mean, you've done it, so yeah. I'm sure your audience members have heard many times over what a fantastic actress you are. I'm here to back that up. Big fan. I was actually doing the math the other day. I think we've known each other for 17 years.
That sounds about right. Jeff and I met each other doing a summer program at the Chautauqua Institute.
We sure
summer before my senior year of college. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And then we wound up at Juilliard together.
Indeed. Group 38, what's up? The last month has been really crazy in a good way. In that certain aspects have felt so normal. Like, so profoundly normal, and other aspects are incredibly bizarre. It is, you know, this is probably the best thing for me has been having a schedule, having a place I have to be every day. It's good for my psyche, just to be able to plan around stuff, because otherwise I'll just, you know, not do anything if I don't have a schedule.
Well, and I've found it increasingly difficult to focus over the course of the pandemic. I don't know, for different reasons, dealing with parenting and such too, but like, I think it probably affects everybody in some way, just the dealing with all of this time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing is if you have all day to do something, then there's no, like, there's no fire under the pot to make it happen. It's like, oh, sometime between now and 14 hours from now, I have to do the dishes. And it's always like 11:30 PM doing the dishes. So, having a schedule has been huge, but it's, I just feel really lucky to have a job, and it's, I do think that everybody involved has a new appreciation for how special it is to be working. Especially because the schedule on, you know, in a professional theater production is can be very grueling, especially when you include understudy rehearsals. You know, it can be very tiring, and just being able to show up and be like, you know what, I wasn't able to do this for a year and a half. I really am glad to be here. And it's also always great to be just around really talented artists. And it was nice to be in the rehearsal room with, you know, with Aaron Sorkin and with Bart Scher and, you know, all the Jeff Daniels and Celia, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, no, and having Jeff Daniels come back and Celia Keenan Bolger come back was really, really special. Is special. They're still there. might not be by the time this airs, but
it'll be a few months, but hopefully they'll still be in it.
We could just, but but yeah, but also like I'm not doing anything, and that's also a reality of it. Is like my job is to be ready, and I am ready. And it can be very hard to sit around and be like, oh, because most days when I show up to work, I feel like I'll show up to work and I'll watch Netflix in the dressing room, or I'll take a nap, or maybe I'll play some video games, and then I'll go home. And it messes with your head, you right. know?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, because you've done a couple of these kinds of gigs, right? Like,
I've done,
or I know you've done a yes lot of long no. runs. They haven't all been yeah. off stage, though.
No, I mean with War Horse. So my first Broadway show was War Horse with our classmate Zach Villa, and I was hired to be the what they called the human swing. There were two swings in the show. There was the human swing and the horse swing, and I covered the ensemble tracks of 26 people.
Oh my gosh.
And that was incredibly stressful. In a, you know, and it was amazing to be a part of that cool show. And, you know, I was really glad to be there. But like it would, every day I'd show up and it would be just chaos for me because, you know, they would have me doing pieces of eight different people's tracks put together in a way that wasn't actually supposed to go that way. Hmm. And yeah, so that was kind of crazy. But, you know, I was in my 20s and what a delight. Right. But yeah, I don't know that I'd want to do that again. And I don't know that I want to do offstage covering anymore after this. Just because I want to, I'd rather be doing the thing somewhere small, you know, or out of town or with my friends in my apartment. I mean, obviously I want to make money, but I don't know. Maybe we should cut that bit out, but.
Well, especially after such a long time of this. Yeah. Because how long were you doing it before the pandemic?
I was with it for 8 months.
Do you find like a level of anxiety over not knowing when you will go on? Of that readiness of feeling like, oh my God, what if it's today and I'm not as prepared today as I thought I was? Or
I definitely did in War Horse. I definitely felt that anxiety just because of the sheer volume of things I had to be ready to do.
That's how I felt during Orphan's Home Cycle, because it was like,
oh my God, well, that was three different plays.
What if what if the wrong track is out and that's the one that I don't feel ready for or something?
Oh my God. Yeah. No, that was a lot of coverage. That was a lot. And a lot of words too.
Yeah.
So
how is it with this one?
I'm covering fewer tracks. Yeah, I'm covering fewer tracks. There's, you know, there's stuff that I need to do, but I've done a lot. And I was really surprised coming back to the show after a year and a half away how much I remembered. And that was something I think a lot of people were saying. You know, it's like one of those things where you stop doing a show for a month and you feel like you can't remember anything about the show. But then you put it in context and you're like, oh, no, that's where I do this and that. And that thing needs to be there, and everybody needs to, you know, it just snaps back in context, which is kind of relieving.
That's good.
The anxiety of, oh no, what's going to happen? Because at War Horse, I would show up sometimes and they would give me, when you have people go out of a show, I'm doing this for the audience members who don't work in the theater. when you have people go out of a show, you will, depending on how the show operates, you will get like a cut show sheet where, okay, so Danny is out, so Steven's going to move into Danny's track, and you know, Kristen is out, and so Annie's going to move into Kristen's track, but then somebody needs to do bits of Annie's track and Steven's track, and then like you merge them together. And I would get a lot of these cut show sheets that would be bits and pieces of different people's parts, and they would have me literally entering and exiting in different costumes at the exact same moment, in different places. And so it was like, I had to be very careful going through those sheets every day, because I'm like, yeah, no, that is physically impossible.
And nobody's double checked this until you've looked at it.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's just, everybody's just trying to get it ready as quickly as possible. And that was a show where we had a lot of people get injured just because of the nature of the show. So, you know, people would be out for a day or a few weeks. I mean, I had my own medical event there. Yes. That was sort of interesting. And
I did want to ask you something about it. Do you want to give like the brief version of what happened, and then I'll ask you my question?
Well, sure. I had a stroke on stage in War Horse. I was 27 or 28. I can't remember which.
Oh my God.
And basically I was having muscular trouble with my neck and from operating one of the puppets in the show. And I went to the PT at the theater and he was like, oh, let me try something. And he grabbed my head and he twisted it really far to the left and he twisted it really far to the right. And it kind of felt like he was like trying to break my neck. But I was like, he's a professional. He knows what he's doing. And what I didn't know then, and for the next, you know, 8 days or 10 days or whatever it was that in doing that, he partially tore both of the arteries in my spine. Ugh. So you have four main arteries in your spine, in your neck. You have the carotids, everybody's familiar with from like Sweeney Todd. Those are the ones in the front. And you have your vertebral arteries.
Love that that's your reference.
Oh, yeah. Come on now. On the Broadway Podcast Network, you got to go with the Sweeney Todd. You have your ones that go up through your spine. Those are your vertebral arteries. So those were both partially torn. And so I didn't know it, but I had these blood clots flying through my system for like a week and a half. And so a week and a half later, it was Sunday, August 5th of 2012. And we had a lot of people out that day, but I was so amped. It was Sunday. Oh boy, the weekend is coming. Yes, please. And so there was a portion of the show, everything was going fine. I mean, for as fine as something can go with a lot of people out unexpectedly. One of our castmates, Ben Horner, his wife had just had given birth to their first child like that night. And, you know, so I'll always remember his child's birthday. But there's a point in the show towards the end where the Joey, the horse, is stuck in no man's land. And that's sort of the area between two trenches in trench warfare. I was getting ready in my position, and there's a point at which four people have to run out and like slide onto the deck, and then the deck starts to rotate as the horse is running around the perimeter, and there's these sounds of explosions and whatnot. So I'm covering one of those people, the four people who slide onto the deck, and I'm in the background area, which we call the Nashscape, which I guess was based off of this artist, Thomas Nash. And then it's our cue, and we run out and we slide down onto the deck, and we get there. There's supposed to be four of us, and there's only three of us. And I'm like the only person who knows what everybody does. Right. So my castmate, Katrina Yaki, who is just a delight, she turns to me and she goes, Jeff, there's only three of us. What do we do? Meanwhile, the deck is rotating. There are explosion sounds going on. And there's a horse running around us, but we're having this, you know, conversation.
Quiet conversation.
On the deck. Quiet. I mean, nobody could hear us anyway. And I'm like, I said to her, because our job was then to get up and help puppeteer this horse jumping over a girder. And I say to her, you're going to have to do both back hooves. Don't worry. We're going to be just fine. which is literally what I said right before I had my stroke. So the deck stops rotating. There was a sound cue. We rolled over to meet the horse. And as soon as I stood up, everything just started spinning.
Oh my God.
Uncontrollably, like, you know, like you're on a terrible roller coaster. And so I just closed my eyes and I leaned on the puppet. I like dug my shoulder into the puppet, thinking at the time, I'm like, I'm really going to piss off whoever is operating this puppet. So we were able to puppeteer the horse jumping over the girder. Meanwhile, poor Katrina Yaki literally has her head up the butt of the horse, trying to puppeteer these two back hooves in a way that was never supposed to happen. And we are able to get over the girder. Then I have to open my eyes and turn and run off. And as soon as I open my eyes, I just, again, everything's just spinning again. And so I sort of fling myself into the darkness. And I land on the deck. And then I hear one of the assistant stage managers come up to me and he says, Jeff, are you all right? And I say, yeah, I'm just spinning. And he says, would you like to come off stage? And I said, yes, please. So he grabbed me by the back of my coat and dragged me off stage. And then I was vomiting for like 16 hours. God. Fun fact, the show didn't stop and people in the audience didn't even know. So it's,
there's
a lot
that.
Going on stage.
Just so you all know, Jeff is on this podcast today, so he's all right. Thank goodness.
Not dead. I mean, I did receive a letter telling me I was dead, but that's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other thing, which is very, very interesting. The state of New York.
The state of New York. Yeah, they sent me a letter consoling me on my own death, but that's a whole other. But that was a paperwork snafu.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com.
I mean, it's a fascinating story. I'm sure we could talk the whole podcast about that. The thing that I was going to ask about it, I'm sure it's affected you and affected your life in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious if after you recovered from that, if there's a way that you've changed your approach to your work, your outlook on your work, the importance of your self-care, the things you're willing to do for a kind of role, for a physical role, for like, were there new boundaries that you set for yourself after that? That's a lot of questions that are all trying to get at the same idea, I guess.
Sure. I mean, I think that the thing I learned most from that was not actually work-related. I've always struggled with my self-esteem and things like that. And always had that little like voice in the back of my head, like, oh, everybody hates you, blah, 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 which I know a lot of people have. And it was really eye-opening to me to see how many people, you know, came to visit me in the hospital. And that was sort of a moment of realizing, and people who you wouldn't expect to, you know, went out of their way to, you know, check in. And it was a reminder that like, even though you and I, for instance, you know, we talk maybe a couple times a year, but we don't, you know, I don't see you every month. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I don't love you profoundly. I do, you know, everybody's living their own lives. Everybody is doing their own thing. And it's easy to feel like you are not cared about when you are.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that chicken soup for the soul thing. No, I think that people would be really surprised by the number of people who care about them. But unfortunately, people don't find out about those things unless something truly dramatic happens. You know, people might not come to your birthday party, but, you know, they care. I don't know. That was a very profound thing. in terms of work, in my work, because this wasn't something, this was not my works. I mean, this was a PT's, you know, error. And I,
no. And that's not what I mean, but I'm just wondering if it changed your outlook or the way you approach things at all.
You know, I don't know that it changed much about how I view work. Maybe it should have. I don't know. No, I guess an interesting thing is that event really was a reminder to me of how unimportant work is. And this is as somebody who loves to work and who loves to be involved with art and wants to do a lot more of it. But, you know, it's in those times where you really have a moment to go, oh, this is important, but not all important. And I frequently will make the error of making work all important. It's funny. When we were in our fourth year at Juilliard, we had this person who visited our classes. And he said to us, the most successful actors are the ones for whom acting is not the most important thing. Do you remember this?
I don't, but I mean, it's something that
it stuck with me.
Been told, but I don't remember who.
And I, at the time, I was furious because, you know, I'm like, no, you know, make it important. And it didn't really make sense to me for a long time, but it does now. It also, I think, depends upon your definition of success. But it can't be all important, because then you're at the subject of a merciless, you know, ocean that will lift you up and crash you down as much as possible. And you have no control over this business. And so letting it have sway over your, which I do, I mean, but letting it have sway over your emotions is a recipe for just misery. So yeah, I mean, people who have something else that is more important, I think that they're definitely the most successful people, mm-hmm. because they're taking power into their own hands. You know, I think I have such respect for people like yourself who, you know, are raising children and being an artist at the same time. Or people who, I'm not a religious person, but people who are really into their religious whatever, I mean, like, that's great too. Because it's just, you can't let this business tell you who you are. I mean, if I let this business tell me who I am, I would think I was a really ugly, violent man, which is just not who I am. But that's who the business wants me to be. You know, I get cast almost exclusively as like murderers or murderers who get murdered, you know, just tough guys. And that's, you know me. So if I let the business tell me who I am, then I'm, you know, going to be unhappy. I don't know. I find myself rambling a lot here. I hope some of this is usable.
It is usable. How do you approach auditions these days with that in mind? With not letting the tempest throw you about and your emotions about, how do you try to stay grounded through the audition acceptance rejection process?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's easier than others. You know, we all have that experience of really wanting something and then not getting it. Shortly after we graduated from Juilliard, I like three sort of little guide rules popped into my head that I've sort of had to remind myself of regularly. And the first one is it's never going to make any sense. And that, I think, really holds true. It's just never, ever, ever going to make any sense. Second rule is it's always going to come down to things you can't control. Because if it was just sheer talent, you know, then I know a lot of people who would be famous beyond their wildest imaginations if it was just talent, but obviously so often it comes down to just things that you have no control over. And then the third rule that came much later than the first two is they who care, he or she or they, or, you know, who cares the least wins. And I don't love saying that, but I do think it's true in that the more you care about something, the more you're going to be in your head. And, you know, it's like that thing that everybody talks about in our business. It's like, it's always like the job that you can't do because you have like a trip, that's the one you book. The job that you don't want to do, that's the one you book.
Do you have any artistic mentors who have been important to you in your career?
That's a great question. I mean, I've obviously had a lot of great teachers over the years. The word mentor to me implies sort of a very personal sort of care, you know, like a guide, you know. And I don't know that I've had friends who I've really who've really taught me a lot about what it is to exist in this business. My one friend, Michael Kostroff, who's a really fantastic actor, has been a really great guide to me in a lot of ways. But yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like the... Because like the way that the theater used to operate, and I'm not talking about anything other than just the actual structure of things, was you're in a company, and you're in that company, and you're going to do 15 plays together. And there are going to be, you know, people of various ages and whatever, and, you know, you work your way through the company. And, you know, I think there's much more opportunity for a mentoring environment in that than there is in sort of a, oh, I did a reading with this person one time, and, you know, they were very... There are actors who I look to show me what it is to live a life like this.
Yeah.
And that is, there's this fantastic actor, David Manis, who I've been lucky enough to do War Horse and To Kill a Mockingbird with. And he is just one, just the sweetest man. But he also has a very good outlook, sort of a clear head about things. And it's not that he doesn't, you know, it's not that he doesn't care, because he does care, but he has a very calm, placid view of the business that I really admire.
No, and I think that's important. I think that totally fits in with everything that we're talking about. Like I even in college, I feel like I was somehow looking for examples of artist couples who had managed to have kids and have a family. Like there was something that I was looking for out of the life as an artist that I wanted to see that it existed and that somebody was able to do it. And so like someone like that, that you're talking about, who's able to do their job well, but not put too much importance on it, to see, keep everything in balance. That makes total sense to me. It's important that we know that that exists, and it's not just everybody sacrificing themselves completely at the altar, you know?
Yeah. It's because it can seem that way. And also, you know, unless you know somebody, you really only know the very surface level of what's going on in their life. Yeah. Like you're talking about, like, artist couples with kids, like that's a whole set of challenges that I don't know what they are. And, you know, having somebody to talk to about that, I'm sure has been fantastic, you know?
Are there any lessons you've learned in the last couple of years that you're really proud of? It could be something small or big.
Lessons that I've learned that I'm really proud of. I feel like there's a lesson I'm learning. I don't feel like I've fully learned it yet. I feel like, well, I mean, I'm learning lots of things all the time, I guess. But I guess I'm worried I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I'm just not that important. And I mean, I'm important in my own life, but I think that, you know, a lot of my own sort of worries about like, oh, does this person, oh, did I say this thing and somebody think it was, mm-hmm. you know, dumb or, you know, all these different things. I'm always making myself the center of the story that I'm in, which, you know, I think a lot of people do, but it's just, I'm just not that important. And
I mean, that's important. I deal with a lot of anxiety too. And I think that even though that doesn't seem to be the obvious issue with it, that's one of the main things that's running through it. As you said, like worrying all the time about what people are thinking of you or what your actions impact is when it actually it's not the center of the situation.
Yeah. Like if you wrong somebody, you know, apologize, make it right. But odds are, I mean, 90% of the time when I think I've wronged somebody, I have not. And then when I apologize, it just makes it weird. So like, what are you apologizing for? I'm like, okay, I'll stop. I'm sorry. Then I apologize for apologizing. And then we get in a loop.
Well, there's two small questions that I usually ask at the end, unless mm-hmm. there's something that I have not asked you about that you were really looking forward to talking about.
You know, I would like to say a thing that I wish I had been told a few years back. Mm-hmm. And maybe I was, and I just wasn't able to hear it. This life, this lifestyle is not linear. And it is going to take turns that you don't expect. And sometimes those turns are great and sometimes they're not. But nothing, the only way that it ends is if you choose to end it. And because I went through a period of like almost 3 years where I just didn't work at all. And I worked at a beer distributor for a year and a half, and I worked in sports marketing for a year, and I was, you know, completely miserable. And I was like, oh, I've washed out of the business. And it's not true. It's not true. And I think that a lot of us, especially when we're not working, can feel like we've been forgotten, or we, or like, oh, that people don't think I'm good enough or whatever, or, you know, and it's just not true. And also an important thing to remember too is people only see when you're successful.
Right.
I mean, they're only aware of you when you're working. They're not aware of you when you're struggling. You know, it's funny, when I started doing Mockingbird, I ran into somebody I hadn't seen in years. But they were like, oh, well, you know, I didn't come out of school and just start doing Broadway all the time coming out right away. And I was like, wow, okay, that is how you perceive my experience. And that is really interesting. Right. Because, you know, I came out of school and I handed out flyers in Times Square for a year. And that was lame. And then I got a nice job and I got, you know, and I was able to do another job. And then I didn't work again for many, many more years. And you're only aware of people's ups. You're not aware of people's downs. And you're always aware of your own downs because you're there.
Especially and with social media that only amplifies that.
Of course. Nobody's going to be like, I mean, people do it and then it doesn't look good either. Like, oh, I'm having a hard time right now. Like, nobody wants to see that.
Yeah,
it's hard, but also like
good to keep in mind.
It is important to remember that. And also, I think it's one of the most beautiful things about the acting business is that you can come into it at literally any age. You can take 20 years off and come back to it and kill it. You know, you can start in your 60s and have a career. It is one of the few I think it might be the only performing art form where that's actually true. There are certain performing arts that physically you can't do after a certain, right. you know, age. There are performing arts where if you don't get that training right off the bat, you're going to be so far behind. But acting is something that And obviously, as somebody who, you know, went through 8 years of college for acting, I'm a big advocate for, you know, getting training. You don't have to. You can get that training in the field. So I don't know. I guess I want people to know that even if you feel like you're out, you're probably not. And everybody probably thinks you're just busy doing something cool, but they haven't heard about it.
Well, thank you for that reminder. I needed that reminder myself. So thank you. When you are kind of in that dark side and feeling disconnected or uninspired, are there any physical things that you return to again and again, like books you reread, music you listen to, like things like that, that you can grab onto that help a little bit?
Sure. There's a great book called The Drama of the Gifted Child. I think it's by Alice Miller. It's a psychology book. And I find that very useful. It's also one of the best acting books I've ever read, actually. Sort of about why people do what they do. But it is a reminder of, like, basically, you know, okay, I'm having this reaction. This is why I'm having this reaction. It sort of talks about, well, I'll let people Google it. It's a good book. And I love listening to music that is atmospheric, I guess would be the word I would use. You know, Steve, I can never know how to pronounce it, Reich or Reich, Philip Glass, stuff like that, I find very calming. I recently made the big leap from thinking about meditating a lot to meditating, which I'm very proud of.
Good for you.
Thank you. Hopefully I'll keep that habit alive.
That's awesome.
But I would not say I am good at it yet. I know that that's probably not a word you're supposed to use about meditation, but I am
consistent,
giving
perhaps?
It a whirl. And it does seem to help, at least, you know, for some period of time.
That's great. And then the last question is, is there anything that you've seen or taken in recently, any work of art that you would like to recommend?
Oh.
A show, a book, whatever it may be.
You know what? I recently rewatched this. I don't even know how I'd describe it, but I feel like people should watch it because I think it's insane and kind of funny, but also very heartfelt and moving. It's called Her Master's Voice. And it is a documentary. I guess you'd call it a documentary. I don't know. Maybe you'd call it a comedy special. I'm not quite sure what you'd call it. About this English comedian who performs a ventriloquist act. And her mentor, who she used to be in a relationship with, passes away. And so he leaves her all of his puppets. And she takes those puppets on a trip to Venthaven, which is, I guess, the World Museum of Ventriloquism in, like, Kentucky or something, to give these puppets to the museum there. There's no description of this.
It has to be experienced.
It is. I highly recommend it. So that is amazing. Something that I saw recently that I would recommend. And I think it's just weird and wonderful. And so, yeah, that's my recommendation of the thing I saw recently.
Fantastic.
Again.
Thank you so much, Jeff. This was so great to just hear about where you're at and to hear your voice. Thank you.
Well, it's always just, you know, it brings me great joy to see your face, to hear your voice, and be in your presence.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month, and anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please review and follow in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Monic Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.